appreciate the presence of all, and would jump right into our remembrance passage, which I would think that most know it, are coming pretty close to knowing it. Matthew 7, 21 through 23. All together.
Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, done many wonders in your name? Then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. And I want to call your attention. Last phrase, lawlessness, or word, lawlessness. The beginning, doing the will of the Father. It is essential that we be a people, both individually in our lives and collectively in our work, organization, worship, that we be committed to doing God's will, not doing our own thing, not practicing lawlessness. And the lesson one on learning from Old Testament departures, the intent of the lesson is to take a look back at history, inspired history, and take stories that most of them we're familiar with. What led them away from God in these? And in the previous lesson, we looked at some things like the dangers of pride, of allowing fleshly desires to control us and to guide our thinking instead of being focused on the spiritual and the things above. We talked about a lack of contentment. And, you know, with the golden calf, there is that temptation. And these things kind of all, like, sometimes blend together. The temptation to unrestrained worship. Hey, as long as we call it worship, we do what we want to do and enjoy it. Lack of faith in God's power are some of the things we talked about. Well, I want us to look at number 5 today, which is set in Numbers 25. The sin at Acacia Grove. And let's get our setting. Can somebody tell me where Acacia Grove was located in, you know, in, just in a general way?
East side of the Jordan.
What?
East side.
The east side of the Jordan. You know, the Israelites, in essence, have completed their wandering in the wilderness. They have crossed the Arnon River. They have defeated Sihon, the king of the Amorites. They defeated Og, the king of Bashan. And this stirred up fear. And the king of Moab had tried to hire someone to curse them. And who was that? Who did he try to get to curse Israel?
Balaam.
And Balaam ends up blessing him. But what we learn in chapter 31, and it is reiterated in the Revelation chapter 2, is that Balaam had an idea. He said, here's how you can get God to curse them. And so here they are, just at the edge of the land of promise, and we have another great failure. And how did the Moabites and the Midianites get Israel to sin? What did they do?
Sent their priestesses in harlots, essentially, for Baal worship.
All right, they used the women and the idolatry. Look at chapter 25 and verse 1. We're not going to read all of this, but I want to get just a few of the verses. Now Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. And look at chapter 31. Now this takes place a little later when they take vengeance on the Midianites. The army fights against them, and they take these captives. And among the captives are the women of Midian. And verse 14, Moses was angry with the officers of the army, with the captains over thousands and captains over hundreds who had come from the battle. And Moses said to them, have you kept all the women alive? look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor, and there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord. The Midianites knew. You appeal to people through the flesh. Balaam knew this, and that's what his counsel was. You throw this feast to your gods. Keep in mind, most sacrifices were not the complete burning up of the animal. There was food, and then there was this harlotry. They were appealing to the sensual. And nobody today is out here offering prostitutes, and that's what they, in essence, were doing. But it's not hard to see that much of religion today, it caters toward the fleshly, sensual side of man. That the worship, it's about making us feel good. You know, that we've got all these physical, fleshly things. And then, while churches, religious bodies, don't offer immorality as an enticement, what they do is they become tolerant of immorality. And they just turn a blind eye to it. And they excuse these things. And so, the change that we've seen in American religion, we often talk about our culture, but just look at American religion and what it, and if we were in another country, we could say the same thing. But American churches have become tolerant of living together before marriage, of divorce, many of them accepting of homosexuality now. I'm not saying it's the same, but it's the same principle. And how many people died in this plague? 24,000. There's a high cost attached to sin, isn't it? And that's something we struggle sometimes to see. We see the appeal of it. We don't see the cost of it. And we need to make sure we do better. This one, I think we kind of covered with the golden calf. I want us to make sure we get to the judges, and I may not get all of these in here, but turn to the book of Judges, and we'll be looking at second chapter, rather. I'm hoping everybody here is familiar with the book of Judges somewhat. Those were not the glory days of Israel, were they? I mean, rape, you've got assassination, you've got idolatry, you've got all kinds of things. These were some bad times. And look at where it came from. Verse 7 of the second chapter, which is, let me suggest to you when you're looking at this, verses 6 through 10 of Judges 2, is what we would probably put this in parentheses, or we call it an aside. Joshua had died, and he's beginning to tell the story of things that happened after Joshua. And then at this point he says, let me just tell you about what happened after Joshua died. Joshua dismissed the people, verse 6, and they went to their place of inheritance. And then the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua. And they continued on in the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done. And then it tells about Joshua's death and burial. Verse 10, when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. It is hard to imagine. But here comes a generation that didn't. I mean, I don't think it by any means he can say, well, they never heard of Yahweh. They never heard anything about Egypt. But they didn't really know God. You know, they weren't truly taught these stories. We must continually ourselves keep studying. We must make certain that we keep the knowledge of God before ourselves and His great works. But then it also, to me, as much as any passage in Scripture, this emphasizes the need to teach our children to emphasize these things. Then we can't assume, well, we know it. They're going to know it. You know, we've got to teach. Don't allow a generation to arise after us that does not know the Lord or the works He's done for spiritual Israel today. Any thoughts on that, any comments? That's one factor. There are going to be three that I identify. The second, they intermarried with the nations around them. I'm probably, because of time, going to skip Solomon. We're going to see the same thing in Solomon. And the people around us tend to influence us. Yeah. Solomon, it will be his wives. And in 1 Kings 11, it's going to actually quote from Deuteronomy 7. Just before they get into the land of Canaan, Moses says, don't allow your sons to marry their daughters. Don't let your daughters marry their sons. They will lead you away. People around us influence us. And one of them, technology is not a bad thing. It's neither good nor bad in and of itself. But technology has allowed influences in our lives, people into our lives that otherwise we've never had any contact with. You know, before there was a television, we would have never had contact with some of the people we do. Then the internet and some of the social networks. Trying to please others. And when we come to Solomon, we come to him. I mean, he did it for his wives. I just wonder how much apostasy through the years has occurred. You know, one, sometimes because of the direct influence that somebody corrupts our thinking. And then sometimes, as like Solomon, trying to make friends and associates happy. But then turn to the last one. And there are two references to this. The last verse of Judges. Judges 21 and verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now the second part of that is pretty obvious, isn't it? There's a problem when everybody does what's right in their own eyes. Because what were they supposed to be doing? Laid out for them in the law. You know, they had the law just before entering the land of Canaan. Here Moses had given them what we call Deuteronomy 28, the blessings and curses. But here's the question. How does the no king enter into this? Because it's one sentence. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we're going to be talking about a king next. The request for the king reflected a lack of faith in God. What did no king in Israel have to do with this? Leadership. We've got our three branches of government. We've got the judicial, the legislative, and then the what? Executive. the king, if he was the right kind of king of Israel, he was not supposed to be a legislator, but he would be the executive. He was supposed to be, you know, an enforcer. And there was no one to enforce the laws. No one to make them do what's right. And as I thought about this, at least I thought about, there's a point to be made, I think, about the value, the necessity of church discipline. But there is also this. In a very real sense, there is no king to make us do what's right. You know, even within the local church, elders, preachers, brothers and sisters you love, that love you, they can try to persuade, but they can't make you.
They didn't have to have a king to do what was right in God's eyes. But they had a mind that was set toward rebellion. And without a king, it just got worse and worse. What kind of heart do I have? Do I have a heart that somebody's got to be standing over me? You know, I mean, think about jobs you've been on. There were people that the boss could have said, look, you know, I'm leaving at, you know, 11 o'clock today. I may not be back until 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And there are people that would work just as hard as they'd ever worked the whole time he was gone. And then there are other people that 3 o'clock the next day, they start getting some stuff together so they can do a little work about the time they think the boss will be back. You know, there are folks that just have to be forced. Well, we can't be that way with God. The period of the judges, you know, people have sometimes said, I wish somebody would make an accurate movie about the Bible. I thought, if they ever made an accurate movie about judges, you wouldn't let your children watch it. You wouldn't want to watch it, you know. It's ugly. And that's why it's ugly. They didn't know God. They were influenced by the people around them toward idolatry. They didn't want to do what was right. And so, the time came, they wanted them a king. And so we come to 1 Samuel 8. And what was the first thing that triggered this desire for a king? I heard something about the nations, but I want you to... Samuel's sons. Let's not overlook them. That his sons did not walk in his ways, verse 3. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, look, you are old. And I'll tell you what, that's some of the most piercing words to me of all of Scripture. You know, they just, you know, you don't think Samuel knew how old he was? You know, but they said, Samuel, you are old. And then here they get down to business. And your sons do not walk in your ways. The first thing was his sons were not good men. You know, there was a failure of the leadership. And bad leadership sometimes causes people to want something besides God's plan of leadership, be it in the home or the church. You know, there needs to be proper leadership. But then it said, verse 5, make us a king to judge us like all the nations. And Samuel said yes, right? What was Samuel's reaction? He wasn't very happy about it, was he? And he felt it. He took it personally. Of course, it's hard not to take it personally when they started off the sentence by saying, you're old. You know, that kind of puts you on the defensive. But Samuel, he took it. God said, no. He said, I want you to show them what a king will be like. And the reality is, God had always known they would have a king one day. Do you remember what Deuteronomy 17 has? Instructions for when they had a king. you know, make sure it's an Israelite. He's to copy the law. He's not to multiply wives or silver or gold, not to multiply horses. God knew the day would come. And the reality is, it's not wanting a king that was so bad. It was their motivations. They wanted a king, first of all, it said, like the nations around them. And the whole problem with that is, God called them to be a holy nation. I separated you to be my people. You know, we can go crazy with this idea of, well, we're holy, we're separate, we're different. And we start looking around and we say, well, we're not going to do that because somebody else does it. You know, and our only reason is, well, you know, I think it was an old preacher from the early 20th century, H. Leo Bowles, who said one time that just because the Baptist and the Methodist come in through the door is no reason for us to feel like we've got to crawl in through the window. You know, and he was just making the point that everything that happens around us is not necessarily wrong. What's wrong is when we start looking around outside of Scripture and trying to imitate others and trying to become, well, they're doing it, let's do it. No, look at the Bible first. But I want you to think with me about this. And I don't know that I always saw this. And if I'm seeing it wrong, y'all correct me. But look at verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, that is, when he told them what a king would be like. And they said, no, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. I think that last part of it is really a big part of why do we need a king to be like the nations? Well, the nations are whooping us. We're losing to these nations around us. We need to, what do they have that we don't have? Not a thought about maybe we're not serving the Lord the way we should. You know, serving the Lord that gave us victory over Sihon and Og and then over all the kings of Canaan. And they once had won the victory. No, their idea is, let's get us, they have kings, we don't have king. If we just had a king. You know, a lot of times when people feel like God's plan's not working, there's really been a failure to work God's plan. And I think that happens far more often than we'd like to think. Thoughts or comments on any of this? Questions? If it's a question, make it an easy one. All right. These are things we need to really grapple with. But look at, and I want you to turn to the account in 1 Chronicles, the moving of the ark. Now, transporting the ark. I decided to go with a big word there. 1 Chronicles 13. I don't know about any of the rest of you, and sometimes maybe when I make these confessions, it just shows how bad I am, but, you know, I knew 1st and 2nd Chronicles were there because I learned to memorize the books of the Bible when I was young, but, you know, I was one of those that I got to 1st Chronicles and I said, wait a minute, we've already seen this in Samuel and Kings, let's just jump on over to Ezra, and didn't spend much time with the accounts in Chronicles. But there are certain times that that First and Second Chronicles really shed some important light on subjects, on accounts, give extra detail. I mean, I've preached on David and the moving the Ark of the Covenant from 2 Samuel 6 more than once before I realized the First Chronicles account gives a lot better detail. Or more detail, I won't say better, because 2 Samuel 6 is there for its purpose. But you look at 1 Chronicles 13, and we think about, remember the Ark of the Covenant had not been in its proper place for many years, and he'd been in Kirjath-Jearim since the days of the judges. And David, you know, we often talk about David. David does not act alone in this. Verse 1, he consulted with the captains of thousands and hundreds and with every leader. And look at how he says it in verse 2 to the assembly. If it seems good to you, and if it is of the Lord our God, you know, we don't want to do anything God doesn't want. David is not, you know, some complete rebel here. He said, you know, here's a thought. And what do y'all think? Is this, you think God would want us to do this? Let's bring the ark back. And all the assembly said they would do so. You know, that I have others on my side doesn't prove I'm right. David had plenty of support. And I believe they were giving it their best. They took a new cart. You know, they didn't go out in the stable and just grab any old thing. They had a new cart. And notice how they, verse 8, were playing music before God with all their might. There was enthusiastic worship. But what happens? They come to the threshing floor. And what happens? The ox stumbles and, yeah, Uzzah puts out his hand to steady it. And what happens to Uzzah? He was killed. He died right there. And notice verse 11. David became angry because of the Lord's outbreak against Uzzah. And if you think about this, now, I'm not excusing David's anger or anything about David in any of this. But it's not really surprising because he had checked with everybody that was a leader in Israel. And they wanted to do this thing. They wanted to please God in it. But they forgot something. How do you know what pleases God? Gather an assembly together and ask everybody what they think? No. You look to God's word. In chapter 15, he calls the Levites and the priests together, tells them to sanctify themselves. You remember the Ark of the Covenant. It wouldn't have been quite this large, but it was a small table, like with the cherubim on top. It had rings, and the poles went through it. And it was to be transported on the shoulders of the priest or the Levites. All the priests were from a branch of Levites called the Kohathites. Any Kohathite could transport it. But if you go back in Numbers and you read, it gave instruction. They were to cover that ark with the blue cloth, wrapped up. It wasn't visible. And he says, you get ready this time to bring up the ark. Verse 13, he says, for because you did not do it the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us because we did not consult him about the proper order. David checked with all the leaders of Israel. He got everybody's approval, except nobody thought to say, let's go get the scroll and make sure it doesn't have some instructions in it. And this time, they looked into it. This time, they were successful. Verse 15, the children of the Levites bore the ark of God on their shoulders by its poles, as Moses had commanded according to the word of the Lord. It makes a difference when we don't just have a show of hands. You know, doesn't this sound like a great idea? Well, let's look first. You know, let's get into the book and seek the answer there. That's so, so important. Bill Hall, I know all of you know him. He sometimes will jokingly say about a certain text, he said, "Now, if you can't preach that, then you're just not called." And, you know, this is one of those. If you can't see the sermons, the lessons, the applications in this one, they're so evident. All right, let's look at yes, sir. Okay. Yeah. Yep. Verse 26, yep. If anybody couldn't hear, 1 Chronicles 15:26, Mike's pointing out, God helped the Levites who bore them. You do it God's way, then God is with you. That is so important. Let me get to the golden calves. I'm going to go past the apostasy of Solomon. That's an important point, but for time. Jeroboam, 1 Kings 11. You know, Solomon's heart is turned away from the Lord. And as I, you know, try to teach the children, those wives caused him to have a divided heart. And so that led directly to the divided kingdom. And he tells Jeroboam, you know, the prophet Ahijah says, you're going to be the king. And the prophet told him, verse 38 of the 11th chapter, if you heed all that I command you, now this is Jeroboam, to Jeroboam, walk in my ways and do what is right in my sight to keep my statutes and my commandments as my servant David did, then I will be with you and build for you an enduring house as I built for David and will give Israel to you. You do what's right and you're going to have an enduring house. Well, Jeroboam becomes king, and what does he do? He lacks faith in God. God said, you do what you're told. And enduring house. He becomes king in chapter 12. He said in his heart, verse 26, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Now what did God said? God said, you do what I tell you and you'll have an enduring house. Jeroboam says, I just don't think I can let those people go worship the Lord the way they're supposed to. And I love this one because what it does, it helps us to see that sometimes what the one proposing an idea thinks is not always how he sells it to others. Because look at what he does. He He asked some advice in verse 28 and made two calves of gold. Now, may I just raise the question, how foolish could an Israelite be to think a golden calf was a good idea? I mean, that was one of their great disasters of Israel, was a golden calf. But he builds a golden calf, and he puts one at Dan and one at Bethel. And as Ty asked me the other day, are you going to use your hand map? You know, when I have my hand map, Dan's way up here and Bethel's way down here. And what did he say? He said, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. I think his selling point is convenience, comfort. You don't think that's a big thing in religion today? Adapt it to the people's needs. And you know, Israel endured as a nation for a little over 200 years, despite these golden calves. You know, Jeroboam's plan seemed to be working, but it wasn't God's plan. Let me give you one last one, and this is one that we all have to guard against. Because sometimes we can look around us and we can see all kinds of evil around us, and we can say, like the Pharisee going into the temple in Luke 18, boy, Lord, I'm thankful I'm not like those people. King Uzziah, he was a good king, and he prospered as long as he did what? Sought the Lord. Uzziah was a great reformer. First Kings speaks some of this. In his time, Judah prospered. But look at what it said in verse 15. The middle part of the verse. So his fame spread far and wide, for he was marvelously helped till he became strong. But when he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction, for he transgressed against the Lord his God by entering the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. Priests would offer the incense. Uzziah is not a priest. What happens though? His pride. His pride led him to do this thing that he shouldn't do. We get to thinking we're so smart and we're so good. We're so big and strong. We have prospered. And the high priest Azariah tried to stop him. And his pride gets in the way again. And it kept him from accepting correction. There is a reason, or many reasons probably, why the Bible continually says to us, humble yourself. Don't be lifted up with arrogance. Let him who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. We need to be careful that our pride doesn't lead us to do things that we want to do versus what God's commanded us to do. Ding dong. Lesson 2 for Sunday morning.